Paul Diehl, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you.
Well, you are a scholar looking at issues of war and peace. And maybe just to start out, I think this definition of peace would be interesting to explore just a little bit. Is peace simply the absence of war, or is there a broader definition that we should be thinking of?
Yeah, I think that most people think of peace as the absence of war. And when they talk about peace agreements ending a civil war, that's what they mean. But in some of my most recent research, we think of peace is the absence of war is negative peace is really just a starting point, and that there are other kinds of forms of peace that bring in greater cooperation, integration across states. Even other kind of definitions refer to justice, economic development, those kinds of things. So I think it's useful to think of a broader definition of peace, because the alternative is you start lumping things together, such as the U.S. and North Korean relationship with that between France and Germany. Neither of them are with war, but we wouldn't characterize those as the same or belonging in the same category.
So it's really a process. It's not simply the cessation of conflict. It is almost a building process.
Yeah, the cessation of conflict or hostility is really almost a prerequisite. And most relationships in the world fall into that category of negative peace. But a smaller set of those, and the ones we often aspire to, such as between the U.S. and Canada, go far beyond that. And it isn't just that there's the absence of war, but in the most peaceful relationships, war and violence is unthinkable.
Well, and you mentioned the U.S. and Canada, a very friendly relationship, very hard to attain. There are other situations where there are perhaps third parties that are involved. So you've done a lot of research on mediation and how third parties can help build this more positive peace. If you can maybe talk a little bit about that and which third parties you're talking about or who's most effective.
It almost really depends on the context for things like that. I think third parties, for the most part, can't force peace, even negative peace, on two warring sides. And I think you see some of that illustration in Syria on the limits of even two of the most powerful states in the world getting many of their allies or surrogates to stop. I think when we talk about mediation, that's something different as a third party. And I think mediators can play an important role in helping parties to come to peace, but like they say about the psychology patients, they have to want to change. Mediators provide the communication channels and the negotiations that will help facilitate the peace, and stronger mediators can provide carrots and sticks that change some of the cost-benefit analysis to those involved and make them more likely to come to an agreement. And once there's an agreement, it's often those third parties who can guarantee that agreement. So imagine that you had some type of ceasefire that occurs in maybe Syria or someplace else. It may be that the third party is the one who provides some assurance or guarantee that they're going to be followed, because almost by definition, the warring parties aren't going to trust each other to keep the agreement.
Of course.
You need some type of third party guarantee.
So these third parties, in most cases, they would be states, or would you suggest organizations? I know you've studied the UN quite a bit. Is that a role that the UN can successfully play?
They have in the past in a number of cases. The UN often appoints a special representative to do that. The advantage of either a UN mediator or someone from the European Union is they're often perceived as more legitimate than a state and considered oftentimes more neutral or less interested involved in that. That's the advantage. The disadvantage is when you move into having UN representatives is they don't necessarily have the political clout or the resources to provide those kinds of carrots and sticks. So, it's something kind of a trade-off. The UN has been successful in achieving ceasefires, facilitating elections as far back as Cambodia in the late 1980s. But on the other cases, they've been repeatedly unsuccessful in the Middle East between Israel and her neighbors, largely because Israel doesn't trust them. But there's a UN guarantee is not very meaningful to either side. It takes a superpower like the United States to be able to pressure both sides and to deliver on a commitment.
What might those sticks and carrots be? What might be some examples?
Well, in one case is the carrots would be oftentimes financial aid that goes with that. So in some of the agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, the U.S. had promised Israel additional military aid and provides economic aid to the Palestinian Authority and things like that. So, you know, those are the things. If you sign the agreement, if you do this, we will provide that. The carrots often come in the form of sanctions or withholding carrots or not giving carrots for that. So those can be kind of economic kinds of sanctions, withholding kinds of military aid, not giving political kind of support, things like that, to be able to do that. I think those are often not quite as effective as the others. And if you're going to, for example, the United States is going to threaten Israel that it will reduce aid if it doesn't stop settlements in the occupied territories, well, first of all, Israel has to, you know, see that that's enough to change its behavior, and second, it actually has to believe the U.S. will do that.
Right, because there are domestic concerns
there are other kind
involved.
Of things,
yes,
that, you know, that would require acts of Congress on the yearly foreign aid budget and other kind of political implications that go with that.
You mentioned Syria, and as we know, in recent weeks, months, Russia and the United States have attempted to get involved, to serve as third parties, to serve as be mediators on some level. I suppose that we still don't know if this has been successful, but what tactics have they taken, and what should they be doing?
Well, you know, what's a little bit odd is you actually have the United States negotiating with Russia to try and influence the behavior of all the other parties in the Syrian conflict. And so, you know, one can be assured that I think the U.S. and the Russia will coordinate according to the agreement, won't bomb certain areas, take certain kinds of actions. But I said the odd thing is we're depending on Russia to deliver the cooperation and the behavior of the Syrian government. And Russia is depending on the United States to have various rebel groups also follow the kind of, you know, the ceasefire in the given areas.
So you have your mediators actually trying to mediate each other.
I'm not even sure kind of a mediator, because usually you think of a third party between two sides. U.S. and Russia are really not what we call third parties, but primary parties, because they're actively involved in the conflict. Russian military is there, and the U.S. is close with special forces and providing aid to the rebels. So it's like I said, it's a very odd situation of as if they're negotiating for other, you know, the groups that they support, and then you have others like ISIS, who, you know, are supported by neither, are not part of the negotiations, and aren't really even covered by the ceasefire.
So that was another question I was going to ask you. We're talking about Russia, the United States, you mentioned earlier Canada, France. These are state actors.
Yes.
And we've talked about kind of IGOs, the UN, the European Union. What about the non-state actors? What about your terrorist organizations? ISIS comes to mind, but also the recent agreement that Cuba brokered between the FARC and Colombia. Yeah. What role can mediation or third-party actors bring when we're dealing with non-state actors?
Yeah, I still think that they can. A lot of the the peace agreements that take place in a civil war kind of context, state actors as well as international organizations, I think, can play kind of important roles. It's often behind the scenes, but I think the third parties you're talking about in those contexts are not necessarily going to be, as mediators, are not non-governmental organizations such as humanitarian relief agencies or others, because their role is more in the implementation of a peace agreement than facilitating it to kind of begin with. You know, but to me, it isn't the identity of the mediator that makes making it with non-state actors and coming to an agreement difficult. The difficulty is in many civil war contexts is you have multiple actors. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you don't have them all at the table or all part of the agreement, you have those who are outside of that and potential spoilers. And even a non-state actors are not like national militaries where there's strong command and control over the actions of a traditional military unit. In many of these rebel groups are made up of, 15 to 20-year-old boys who aren't necessarily under the full control of the commanders. So even if you had the commanders of a given rebel organization, the degree to which they can stop the kind of violence that's taking place by those who are acting under their name is much more limited than if you have a traditional military and a leader or a general orders them not to take certain actions or to move out of kind of an area. So it's a much more difficult kind of context to get all the right folks to the table, get them to agree, and then finally to implement the agreement. And each of those three steps are fraught with perils.
How do you get them to the table? You said they have to agree, they want there to be peace. Yeah. There's also this confusion about who represents who and getting people to follow. What sort of recourse is there short of what's been tried?
Yeah, right. I mean, getting them to the table, political pressure from third parties can work. But, of course, just getting them to the table doesn't get you an agreement.
Sure.
I think those who study the process of starting negotiations and assuming that the parties are sincere about coming to a peace agreement find that it's most common in protracted conflicts where each side sees that there is what we refer to as a hurting stalemate, is neither side can win at the point and is incurring lots of different kinds of costs. And to move beyond that, if you have that kind of situation where you have a stalemate, you can see some of that in Syria and elsewhere, where neither side looks like it can win, you have the potential there. But the negotiations have to offer a potential agreement that provides a way out for the particular parties involved. And I think that's the kind of incentive to at least get them to talk. But then the hard parts come about, what would the agreement look like? Who's going to guarantee it?
And what's it going to look like 5, 10, 15 years later? I mean, I think that's the other question. How do you maintain the momentum if we're thinking of peace as a long-term project?
Right.
Your third-party actors, whoever they may be, often are much more interested with go in, try to resolve, right. Go out. And in my mind, I'm thinking of the Balkans in this instance,
yes.
Where we were very involved. The United States was very involved in international organizations where there is no violence there, or the conflict there has subsided, but there are certainly a number of issues that remain.
Yeah, there's not necessarily in the aftermath of the former Yugoslavia what I would term as positive peace
right.
in there. You have had a lot of the refugees and others repatriated and resettled, but in many cases they haven't gone back to their original villages and cities. They've gone to areas which are much more homogenous in terms of ethnicity and things like that. And you have within Bosnia-Herzegovina, essentially two sub-states, mm-hmm. One by the Serbs and one by the Bosnian Muslims that operate kind of almost independently
right.
with an extremely weak kind of national government.
Perhaps laying the
yeah.
groundwork for future conflict.
Oh, well, it's certainly better than people killing each other
absolutely.
In genocide, but it falls short of the kind of aspirations they had for putting that country back together.
So third parties that want to be involved have to think more holistically, have to think more long-term, and that's a hard sell.
That is, and there's lots of other factors that can happen kind of in the long term. I also often don't think that when it comes time to stopping a civil war that most leaders and negotiators think necessarily about what those long-term arrangements are. I think their main priority is perhaps it should be is stopping the fighting. And then most of what you can put in a peace agreement are provisions that deal with the short term, which may be the disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of rebel forces. It may be the scheduling of elections within a reasonable period of time, and it may be other kind of short-term kind of security arrangements. But, it's difficult to project out 5 or 10 years and build, conditions which you never may reach, into any other kind of peace agreement. I mean, first of all, they're hard to envision, but second, they may also be complicated in getting to the initial agreement if you try and put too much into a peace agreement.
Absolutely. Well, I think complicated is definitely the word here, but we will continue to watch and see what happens in the former Yugoslavia and certainly what happens in Syria as we're, 5 years into a civil war there, and we will see if the third-party actors can get it together and maybe some sort of peace or at least a cessation will occur. So thank you so much, Paul, for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Glad to do it.